Sounds True presents Experiments in Truth, Session 2, The Breath Inside the Breath, Part 2, recorded at the Brighton Bush, Oregon Retreat Center in August of 1994, with Ram Dass.
This is a quote from a chapter called Naturally Liberating Whatever You Meet. It's in something called The Crystal Cave. On the one hand, when you regard disturbing emotions as emptiness, your practice turns into taking emptiness as the path and not the disturbing emotions. Thus, your practice doesn't become the short path. On the other hand, if you indulge in the disturbing emotions, thinking they are something concrete, it's like eating a poisonous plant and is the cause which binds you to samsara. Any disturbing emotion that may arise is wisdom the moment you relax to your natural mind. Look directly into it. Don't deliberately reject it, regard it as a fault, indulge in it concretely, or regard it as a virtue. The more I live my life tuning to Dharma, certain words come through really strongly, like the word balance and the word patience. I see myself going through life in which phenomena appear, and some of them captivate me immensely, and my awareness goes into a thought relationship to that particular phenomenon. And at that moment, I lose some balance. I lose the spacious ground in which that phenomena exists. And then sometimes I keep letting go of thoughts, letting go of thoughts, letting go of thoughts, until there is just awareness. And resting in that, you lose the world. But I experience my life as a dance of balancing, of cultivating the qualities of spaciousness, of equanimity, of peace, of happiness. But I noticed that there were certain stages in my development, and they're still going on, and it's left over in a way from my renunciate models, where I haven't yet fully re-entered into the passions of life because I'm afraid of them. Because I'm afraid they will captivate my consciousness and take me away from my balance too much. And I realize you shouldn't be afraid of anything. I agree. But I am afraid. And I see myself getting closer and closer to the edge of my fear of coming back into some passionate joy about something in the world, something I would have been afraid to do for fear of losing my quiet spaciousness, and realizing that now my quiet spaciousness is still present, that it's still empty, clear, quiet. I was doing interviews, and I'm doing one interview about every 6 or 7 minutes. Now, many people have come for an interview, prepare, they spend time thinking, what will they say? And they get it down to the kernel of the essence of the neurosis, or the kernel of the essence of the drama, the pain, confusion. And they hand me the kernel with all of its juice. And it's our kernel, it's our juice, it's our stuff. And it's my stuff as well as their stuff. I mean, it's just us, kids here, you know. And I watch, because my job in that position, and my job in life, but that position demands it, is that I keep that balance perfectly. That at that moment, if I don't open my heart to the fullness of what that individual's pain or essence problem is, what they experience is that I'm not hearing them, that I don't understand, that they're alone inside their predicament. because I didn't allow my empathy, the passions that my empathy would engage, I didn't allow it to occur. So I open myself, and sometimes my heart breaks because a person's predicament is a heartbreaker. But then the other part of me is constantly coming back into just awareness, just that presence that looks at the emotional states, works with them, doesn't push them, doesn't pull them, doesn't grab them. And that part of me becomes a mirror for the other person, for them to see the way in which they're caught. In other words, the two bits of information that my presence there is offering is one, the empathy, we're all in this together. And the other is, but we don't need to be caught. This is two bits of information. And I realize now more and more that what we offer each other as human beings is an environment. And what that is doing is keeping me in the environment of that balance. So that I'm an environment where if that other person wants to come out and play from the pain and the suffering, here I am. And if they're in the pain and suffering, here I am. But there's nothing in me that's keeping them stuck in the pain and suffering. And there's nothing in me demanding they come out. And that's the interesting one. It's the interesting one about your morality regarding other human beings' consciousness. Tim and I wrote an article back in 1963 for the Harvard Review called The Politics of Consciousness, in which we are arguing that each individual should have a right to do with their consciousness as they choose. And that's what a free system should allow. It's amazing how we don't do that in our society. And of course, it was around psychedelics at that time. But now I can see it. I see it particularly, for example, in the way in working with people that are approaching death. Because there is such a desire in somebody that is on a path of Dharma to have that other person die your death. Die the death you think they should die for them to be liberated. And to me, I've learned over the years, one is it doesn't work. Because when you push against somebody, even the subtlest model in your head, they should be different than they are, awakens in them at a very unconscious level, pushing back. And I have noticed in my human relationships that as I want less and less from each individual, there is much less paranoia in them at a deep level, and they are much more available immediately. And the interesting thing is, what does it mean to be a safe space for another human being? A safe space means you don't have an agenda. But we have this tendency to have a model because we're trying to justify the way we're living our lives. So to me, that word balance is a really key issue. I mean, there are so many little balances we work with. The balance between the kind of intuitive heart and the thinking mind. As you get too much thinking, the energy goes up and there's a whole contraction in the system around thinking. And there's a tendency in the spiritual journey to denigrate thinking, to denigrate intellect, to denigrate analytic mind. And I think that we as Westerners, coming out of our history of having the intellect be the highest power that we have. And now as we're shifting the balance, it is important that we don't throw out the baby with the bath. And I think we are inclined to learn how to integrate these two things so that we can honor and delight in the beauty of the intellect without being trapped by it. As they say, the ego or the analytic mind is a beautiful servant and it's a lousy master. And you can sense as you look at the world conditions how the best of intellect don't solve our problems ultimately. Because our problems require a different level of wisdom. And we have worshipped knowledge rather than wisdom. And wisdom has in it a very deep compassion. Maharaji said, see everyone as God. The reason I'm saying all this is because you and I spend a huge amount of time in interpersonal relations. And the question I ask you, since you and I aren't going to monasteries to live our lives, since that's one of the things we do so much, wouldn't it be nice to make your human relationships the vehicle for becoming free rather than the vehicle to stay entrapped? And what is required is a shift in the way in which one looks at relationships, what they're about, what their function is. We have come out of a psychological morass. Freud and all of the personality people took us down a road. It's hard to appreciate how deep in it we are. How deep in the doo-doo of personality. How real it all is. I mean, you all think you have needs that must be met. You all think you have personality identities that must be honored. And even as I say that, I can feel you get tight, defending your right to have those things. Isn't that true? Yeah. I can feel it in myself, too. You know, I have a right to be angry. Damn right I do. We'll wait. You know, there's no rush. When you finish that trip, we'll still be here. Because awareness isn't in time. It's just here. So you want to enjoy your neurosis? Enjoy. Enjoy. Have more. Have another helping. Really climb in. Really climb in. We have gotten so thick in it, and so you're either getting into it through abuse of this or that, or you spend the rest of your life getting out of it, which is all giving it that plane of reality so much juice. And you look at your relationships from the point of view of your separateness. How will you fulfill my needs? I'll be who you need me to be if you'll be who I need you to be. Now, that kind of symbiosis, that's all fine if you don't get trapped in it. But if you get trapped in it, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare rooted in your sense of separateness. It's like feeding the illusion of the separateness, which is the root cause of the pain. So if the game is to be happy, the question is whether fulfilling your needs makes you happy. And whether fulfilling your needs makes you any happier than not fulfilling your needs. It's an interesting one. It does for the moment, there's no doubt about it. But if you notice that when you live on the realm of needs, the minute one is done, another one appears. You have a hierarchy of needs, like a motivational hierarchy. I need food. Now I need ice cream. Now I need television. Now I need a cold drink. Now I need some popcorn. Now I need to go to bed. Now these are all going on all the time. We all have needs and desires. We all have all the stuff. But just like I'm not going around being a bald man, I am bald, relatively speaking. To those of you that don't have eyes to see. But my consciousness is not full of baldness. It's an also-ran. Sure. In my hierarchy of desires, if I have yogic powers that Patanjali talks about, I'll create a beautiful head of hair for myself. As a whim, just to I did it on the astral plane, so those of you that can see know that that's And if you see the way in which people get encrusted in their personalities, you can look at somebody and the way they stand, the way they dress, the muscles of their face, the redundancy is staggering of a person saying, this is who I am. This is who, they're basically saying, this is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. So you see helpless people going down. This is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. This is who I am. Then you see bankers. This is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. You see car salesmen. This is who I think I am. This is who I am. Laid back hippies. Hey man, this is who I think I am. Hey baby, this is who I am. And everybody gives you a little matrix. They're walking down the street with these huge mind nets. And the net goes out and it catches you. And you immediately go into the, I'll make believe you are who you think you are if you'll make believe I am who I think I am. So you don't even look to see who it is. You don't see God as your only friend. You don't see that could be God in drag. You know. You see who they think they are. And you respond to it. And so everybody is going into the personality realm, making it real, and then interacting. And then looking at each other. And when you think your personality is real, that's all you see when you look at other people. You don't see that other planes of consciousness. I like the image of the man in a rowboat rowing through the fog. And he hits another boat and he screams at the other boatman, why don't you look where you're going? And the fog clears for a moment, and there's nobody in the other boat. It was just floating. And you're left with, because at that moment, the plane of consciousness shifted. There was nobody there. Well, imagine there isn't anybody anywhere. There's only one of us. There's just awareness. There's nobody. Who do you talk to? Can you and I enter into a dialogue knowing neither of us are real? Can we have needs without really thinking of them as who we are, where we're living? It seems to me that we come together through roles, through personality structures, through all these things. These are the vehicles through which we meet. These are the vehicles. The identification with the vehicle becomes a tremendous trap. And part of the yoga of relationship is to meet through the vehicle of all that stuff, but recognize that through the process of relationship, my relationship with you, let's find our way out of being trapped by that together. You help me and I'll help you. So that we can be in the roles in a kind of celebratory, free, playful way. I mean, take everything you're doing in your life, and instead of characterizing it now as need and pain and problem to be solved, like I used to be with Tim Leary, and the world would be falling apart, believe me. All the cars out in the parking lot would all be broken. These were new cars we had bought. The furnace would have exploded. We were in debt, everything. And I'd say, Timothy, we have a problem. He'd say, how many times do I have to tell you, Richard, we don't have a problem, we need a plan. And it was just like a little flip of consciousness. I mean, I've had a series of friends who have helped me escape from my own mind again and again. It's a great blessing to have them through humor, through demand. I remember driving across the country with a friend once, and we were driving along, and I was busy being neurotic and getting somewhere, and we'd pass a store, the Grand Union supermarket, and he'd say, Grand Union. I'm looking on the map to find out where we're going to have lunch, you know, and he's busy with Grand Union. But it would sink into my consciousness as if from a distance. It would slowly filter its way in until, oh, shit, man, you know. Merge. I mean, you do them all dead end. Just constantly flipping consciousness. I'm just playing with all of this stuff. So you just to think about relationship as yoga. I mean, my history of being a therapist and having clients was that during that time, my psychodynamics were such that I was so not resting in my being but in a feeling of inadequacy, psychodynamic inadequacy that was fulfilled through proving myself through the world and in other people's eyes, something that I'm sure somebody here understands. That when I finally got to be a therapist, I really needed to be a therapist. And I needed my patients to be patients. They were called patients in those days. I needed my patients to be patients. And I needed to be curing them. I didn't need to cure them because then they'd leave me. And then I'd have to go find another one. So I needed them to be being cured and be deeply appreciative of how I was curing them. But I needed them to stay a patient. I mean, I was going to sit at the side of the desk with the knee hole, and I had the clipboard. I mean, you just think of this pathology now in terms of where we've come in the years since then. This was 30 years ago. But I realize now, when I look at my dynamics, how punitive I was of somebody who came to me who was strong, who didn't really need me in that way, who wanted to become free. I mean, I say kiddingly, but it's not so funny that if I in those days met who I am today, who came into his office, I would hospitalize him. Because who I am now would be such a threat to who I was then. So I invite you to examine the way in which your identity with your roles and your personality dynamics are creating a very rigid system with other people, and whether or not you are using the relationships in a way to get free from that. And first of all, do you realize you're entrapped in them? That is, I mean, I wrote a chapter in How Can I Help called Helper's Prison with Paul Gorman. And the way in which you get into helping because it makes you feel righteous, it relieves suffering, it's all good things. So you get into, I'm a helper. And I realized as I examined the dynamics of my own helping and the helping of the people around me, how disempowering this was to everybody else around them. How it needed helpless people to help. And I was seeing how you could give something to somebody in one way where you're identified with the giver, which forces them to be the receiver. Or you could give somebody to someone and yet not be caught in giving and receiving, but just be in shared awareness. It's like when I give these beads from my right hand to my left hand, the right hand didn't get caught in giving and the left hand didn't get caught in receiving. There was no giver, there was no receiver. And yet there was a giver and receiver. That's the key. There was no giver and receiver, and yet there was a giver and receiver. How do you play the roles? How do you have the needs without being trapped in them? And the first part of it is to realize you're in prison. To realize you are trapped. Not really, but you are thinking you're trapped. And what that appreciation does, and that's the appreciation of the nature of Dharma, what that appreciation does is it changes the way in which you look at your life experiences. It's the same thing about the issue of coming into your passion. Or as Alan Watts once said to me, Richard, you're too attached to emptiness. Meaning I was pushing away the form too much. And the form becomes the curriculum. The form is the projection of the mind. Which forms you see, that's your karma writ large. And the issue of extricating oneself from those clingings, not to be not in them, but to be in them and not in them. Now you have the possibility of being with other people who are not trapped, who are always in that spacious awareness. Ramana Maharshi's beautiful example, just very, always so simple and present and loving. That blend of compassion and emptiness, that's the way those come together. I was in Madras, I believe, and I met a man who was in his 50s, I guess, and he had grown up as a small child around Ramana Maharshi. And he used to sit on his knee and all that. And then he grew up and he became an army officer, and now he was sort of retired or something like that. And he said, one day, he said, an English gentleman came to the ashram. And he said, this English gentleman was the head of a large set of businesses, and one of his set of businesses was in Madras. And the businessman was having trouble sleeping, and he was very agitated and very upset. And the manager of his Madras store said, of a business said, you should meet this saint at Arunachala, Tiruvannamalai. And so the Englishman agreed, and he flew over to India in a flying boat, as the story was told, whatever that means. I guess a seaplane. And he came to Madras, and his manager took him to see Ramana Maharshi, and he was going to stay there for several weeks. And he came into the hall, and the hall was silent. Everybody was sitting there. And he sat down, and nothing happened. Right, now, this is a very successful businessman. And he started to get more and more agitated. And it was about 15 minutes before he couldn't stand it any longer. And he stood up, and he was like, I'm leaving here. This is silly. I can't spend my time this way. And Ramana Maharshi, who very rarely talked, said to him, sir, before you leave, would you do me one favor? The man said, yes. Would you be kind enough to write a note to your wife? What a bizarre request. All right, if that's what you want. So they brought him paper and a pen, and he wrote, dear Hilda, I didn't find what I wanted here. I'll be back on Tuesday. Did you water the plants? And has Doris gone to the dentist? Signed, Henry. And Ramana Maharshi held out the hand, and the note was getting hot. Ramana Maharshi folded it, and he put it up under his buttock, which was naked. And he said, would you be kind enough just to stay with me for 5 more minutes? The man said, all right. Sat down. And they sat there for 5 minutes. Then Ramana Maharshi got up, and he started to shuffle out of the room. And as he passed the man, he handed him the paperback. And then he went out of the room, and the man said, like, what kind of crap is this? What am I doing? I've come here. This guy's mad and insane. And he looks down at the paper, and it's on a different piece of paper. And he opens it up, and it says, dear Harry, I'm sorry you didn't find what you want in India. I have watered the plants. Doris has gone to the dentist. I would write a longer letter, but the tall man with the turban who brought you a note is insisting I answer very quickly. Signed, Hilda. Now, those are cheating. Those are miracle stories. They're really not anything at all. But it's just fun to hear a story like that. Just to realize the game is played on many levels. Many levels. Shirdi Sai Baba, not Satya Sai Baba, but Shirdi, the old Baba. He was a miracle Baba. He said, I give people what they want so they'll want what I give. Because you realize that freedom has nothing really to do with miracles at all. Miracles are just reminding you that it's not the way you think it is. And that frees you a little bit to be able to wonder, how is it? When you wonder how is it, you're hooked. So you enter into a relationship with another person if you're lucky. Could be a friend, it could be a partner, it could be a fellow employee, it could be somebody you meet once a month or once a week or to study with or something like that. Will you enter in with the contract? Let us help each other awaken. Let us help each other remember together. Let's use our relationship to remind ourselves that we're stuck, that we don't have to be stuck, that we are already free, we're just busy being stuck. And these are very, very precious relationships, and they are very rare. I wish there were more of them. I wish we all had them all the time. But they are rare. And a lot of people who say they'd like to enter into that don't really want to. They just want to be somebody who wants to want to enter into it. And that's most of us. Because you come to the point where you are so familiar holding on to who you think you are, your psychodynamics, that you take even the fancy contract to awaken and use it in the service of your psychodynamics. I'm helping you awaken, for God's sakes. You're trapped. And I'm free, and I know I'm free because I see how trapped you are. Damn it. I love it. Oh, boy. I think when you're working with another person in being free together, so that each moment in a relationship is the moment for us to be just here together, dancing through the form. It's like the form of lecturer and listener. Can you hear without getting caught in listening? Can I speak without getting caught in speaking? Can you and I be together through this dance of talking and listening? Does this talking and listening separate me from you because you're them? Or am I in the world of us sharing this breath together? And is it bringing the us closer together? I have all these little aids, mechanisms, techniques to remind me. They're all traps. They're all traps. All methods are traps. I mean, meditation is a trap. You don't want to end up a meditator. You want to end up free. Judaism is a trap. This is a hard one for those that are Jews. You don't want to end up a Jew. You want to end up free. I was just in Israel, and I tried saying things like that. This is... Sure, then you delight in all the forms. You delight in your sexual identity and your religious identity and your social and economic identities and your political identities and all of your family identities, but you're not trapped in them. And in relationships, there is a balance. You don't ignore the personality stuff because it's still real to people. You fulfill it in the way you can without getting lost in it. It is up to the most conscious person in a relationship to create this space where the relationship can grow. And I'd be with Maharaji, and I'd be very serious about something, and he'd just giggle. And what I'm left with over the years are things like the giggle. Because Maharaji was, for me, that mirroring process. And yet he was passionately alive. He was chiding and throwing things and screaming at people and laughing and holding and doing all that stuff. And at the same moment, it was just like a vast mountain of emptiness. We were all busy with our personality. Who can get his foot to massage it? Who can get closest? Who will he give a name to? Who will he love the most? There was a guy who I knew from the States. He was kind of unbalanced at that time because he had had a bad love affair. And so I told him to come to India, and he came to India. And every time he tried to get near Maharaji, Maharaji would push him away. And I got really upset with Maharaji because this guy really needed something. So I brought him into the room, and I'd sort of aim Maharaji at him, you know. And Maharaji would ignore him completely, and I would get more and more furious with Maharaji. And then at one moment, Maharaji turned and attended to him, and within a week, that guy had moved into the top slot in the whole temple, and he was going into the room when I couldn't, and I was hating that guy, absolutely detesting him. It was absolutely extraordinary. It's interesting that this kind of stuff we do when we come together and we study and we work and we meditate and we sing and we do all this, and we do it over years, and you can feel how we are changing. We are slowly, 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 and there's no time again, so it could happen for a person in a moment, but you can feel the process going on of lightening up, of not taking the personality so seriously, of not taking the dramas of life, not getting so trapped in them. Not pulling back, but not being trapped. Passionate involvement and emptiness. A joy that doesn't deny what is in the world, and isn't trapped by it. And it's all process. It doesn't end. It's just a continuous process. Continuous process. Maharaji kept a diary. And every day in the diary, I mean, can you imagine a realized being keeping a diary? What do you suppose he thought was significant that he wrote down every day? 2 pages he wrote every day. And he had books of it, book after book. There were all stacks of these books. Every day, 2 pages. He wrote all the critical events that happened during the day. If you open the page, it says, Ram, 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 Ram. Just 2 pages of Ram, 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 Ram every day. And when he was about to die, he gave it to Siddhima, this incredible woman. He said, would you keep my diary from here on in? It was called his diary. And he was just bringing it all back into its source all the time. Bringing it all back into its source all the time. And he was still doing practices. But it wasn't practices out of need, it was practices out of celebration. He was just celebrating it all. And then just this one other little story. I knew, I could tell in my inner gut who he was. And I knew who I was. Hear the tone? I was, and I knew who he was. And I wanted what he had, so I'd have it too. And the problem was he kept distracting me all the time. You know, you come and he talked to me about America. Who gave a damn about America? I wanted to get enlightened, you know. And I saw that more talking about America didn't get me anywhere. So one day I determined not to be sucked in. And I was brought out to the temple with this Indian man. And there was just this Indian man and me and Maharaji. It was late in the, it was sunset. So the Indian man and I came up to Maharaji's tucket and we sat down in front of him. And I decided I had been reading Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga. So I brought my awareness to my third eye, my ajna, and I sat there. I went into meditation. Like, damn it, you give me what I want. And he said, Ram Dass. And he started to ask questions, and I ignored him. I wasn't going to have any bullshit. He wasn't going to con me this time. I wanted it now. At which point, he leaned over on his elbow, and he started to snore. And when he snored, my body absolutely exploded. I mean, it was Kundalini City in there. My head started to shake, and my whole body was shaking, and I thought, I really experienced that I was about to break my neck. It was so violent. And I was getting frightened, and at that point he sat up, and the whole thing stopped. And he said to the guy, ask Ram Dass how much money Stephen makes. I mean, what he's basically saying, if you'll pardon the crudity, was stop fucking around. When you're ready, you'll get it. You know, stop being greedy, be patient, don't rush, you know. You know, get over that trip. Relax, it's okay. It's okay. Because ultimately, it's so ordinary that all the little increments in energy you don't even notice. It's not like I've got all this power. So I encourage you to look at your relationships as vehicles for awakening. Now, there are two kinds. One is where you've got somebody in it that wants to awaken with you, and the other is where they don't. And those are just two different kinds of yoga for you. One is with satsang and one is without it. But the interesting thing about the one without it is that's in your own head. They're satsang, they just don't know it yet. And you're not demanding they be satsang. You're just looking through the veil of their mind's denial of who they are to be with who they are. But you can only do that when you're resting in it. Because it takes one to see one. So you're constantly working on yourself, just coming back into that balance, into that equilibrium, and then looking and seeing everybody else here in the same space with us. We're all here together. We're all in this awareness. And then you see people dipping down, getting caught into their needs, desires, fears, personality, and losing the balance. And you're just sitting here saying, ah, losing the balance. Ah, so relationship as a vehicle, patience. See, realizing there's nobody in the other rowboat. There's nobody in the other rowboat. The excitement of being with another human being, and you've been lost in your drama for thousands of incarnations together. And then you start to come up for air together. What an incredible joy to be with another human being and be free. And the far out thing is, it takes exactly one moment. I would watch, I'd stand behind Maharaji, and they'd, like, the army had Hanuman as their Ishtadev, their divine form. So Hanuman is on all the army flags in India. And the army trucks would be coming from the China border, and they would come by the little temple up in the Himalayas, and the trucks would all stop, and everybody would come into the temple, because it was a Hanuman temple, to pranam, and Maharaji was there, so they'd all line up to pranam, and then they'd be given food, and then they'd go back. They were always fed at the temple. And Maharaji would be sitting there, and these army guys would be coming along, touching his feet, rushing off, touching his feet, rushing off. And he'd be talking to people, and he'd just have a foot out there, and they'd be touching his foot and rushing away, touching his foot and rushing away. And every now and then, he'd turn to somebody, and he'd say, your mother needs to hear from you. Then he'd go back to talking. I was standing behind him, and I watched the guy go. And then I'd watch, most of the people came by, and you saw the denseness of them being in honoring the guru. They were in a definite role game, deep in honoring the guru, get food, go. I mean, they weren't doing it to get the food, by the way. I mean, this is a very pure situation. But every now and then, one would come and touch and look up, and you would see something happen at that moment. You just see something happen. And you knew that that whole person's life, something was going to be different from then on. And it only took that long. I realized that his business with me took that long. All the rest of it was collecting more out of my fear that something hadn't happened, which is far out. But you're more or less stubborn as to how quickly you will give up, you know? Damn it, my personality's real. I need love. I'm lonely. Good. Is it fun? How do you do? I'm Dick. She wasn't there for me when I really needed her. Oh, God. I was there for you many times before that. Boy, oh boy, you watch it, it's like, hey! Hey, everybody! Wow, wow, dig this one. Look at this. This is really thick. Will they ever get out of it? No, I don't think so. It's all the stuff we're all in, right up to our eyeballs all the time. Does anybody want to get free? So relationships are a stinker of a yoga. Because just like institutions, they are an institution. Because it's so easy to go to sleep into them. I won't bug your ego if you don't bug mine. I guess one of the bits of wisdom I'm passing on is not to take yourself so seriously. To take it all lighter. To take it all a little bit more with hay. You know, hay. Wavy Gravy, our clown who's on the board of Seva, has always told us, if you don't have a sense of humor, it just isn't funny. And he has the serious glasses, the Groucho Marx glasses, on the puja table. And if anybody at the board meeting, when we're talking about death, destruction, violence, blindness, malnutrition of children, uses the word serious, they have to put on the serious glasses. So we won't take ourselves too seriously. Because taking something serious doesn't make it go away any faster. In fact, it keeps making it a little bit worse. And I just like this particular story. A shepherd was grazing his sheep when a passerby said, "That's a fine flock of sheep you have. Could I ask you something about them?" "Of course," said the shepherd. Said the man, "How much would you say your sheep walk each day?" "Which ones? The white ones or the black ones?" "The white ones." "Well, the white ones walk about 4 miles a day." "And the black ones?" "The black ones too." "How much grass would you say they eat each day?" "Which ones? The white ones or the black ones?" "The white ones." "Well, the white ones eat about 4 pounds of grass each day." "And the black ones?" "The black ones too." "How much wool would you say they give each year?" "Well, which ones are you referring to, the white ones or the black ones?" "The white ones." "Well, I'd say the white ones give some 6 pounds of wool each year at shearing time." "And the black ones?" "The black ones too." The passerby was intrigued. "May I ask you why you have this strange habit of dividing your sheep into white and black each time you answer one of my questions?" "Well," said the shepherd, "that's only natural. The white ones are mine, you see." "Ah, and the black ones?" "They're mine too."
This concludes session 2. Our program continues with session 3.